One for Mum, one for Dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and I want to welcome you to our summer series, where each week we'll be bringing you conversations from our webinars held in 2021. This episode, we're chatting with the National Secretary of the Australian Council of Trade Unions, or the ACTU, Sally McManus, who was in conversation with Jim Stanford, the economist and director at the Centre for Future Work at the Australia Institute. And they were talking about the broken bargain with Australian workers, who face record low wages growth and increasingly insecure work, especially during the pandemic. This episode was recorded live on the 14th of July 2021, and things may have changed since recording.
Ebony, thank you very much for that. I should acknowledge that I'm speaking from unceded Indigenous territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations here in Vancouver, British Columbia, where I am on this side of the Pacific. Until the government, the Commonwealth government, gets its act together on vaccines. Unfortunately, I'm over here instead of in Australia, but I'll be back as soon as I can. It is just a wonderful honor and privilege for us to welcome back Sally McManus to the Australia Institute's mega webinar series. It's a great time as well, because the ACTU is heading into its Congress, its triennial Congress, later this month. It'll be a very important moment where the unions come together online, unfortunately, this time, but they still come together and debate and plan their strategy and figure out how they're going to change Australia for the better. And it's a really important moment in the union movement's history. And we're really glad to have Sally here in advance of that to talk about the key priority of wages and how we fight back. Now, it is not usual practice to read someone's bio, and I almost never do that, but Sally's bio is unique, precisely because it's a lot like her. Short, blunt, to the point, no muss, no fuss, or if I can use the technical term, no bullshit, okay? Here it is, Sally McManus, the 10th Secretary of the Australian Congress of Trade Unions. She was the leader of her union, the Australian Services Union branch in New South Wales, representing community, public sector, and private sector workers, and started there as a trainee organizer in 1994, and then became state secretary and led an incredibly important campaign, among many others, for equal pay in the community services sector. And that's important to remember, because we just passed a milestone from that victory, because the transitional funding that the Commonwealth government at the time, when they supported this obviously was not a Liberal government at the time, the funding ran out. So there was a big fight last year to make sure that the funding was committed. And we worked with the ACTU around and the ASU about what it would mean if the funding wasn't reaffirmed. And it was reaffirmed, an important victory showing that unions make a difference. Finally, her bio says Sally has also worked as a Pizza Hut delivery driver, a shop assistant and cleaner, and studied philosophy at university. And I can tell you that Sally puts all of those experiences to work, both understanding the realities of working people, but also having a perspective on how society works in order to guide our strategic interventions. I do a lot of work with unions around the world, and I can tell you 100%, you will not find a more principled, powerful, and effective union leader anywhere than Sally McManus. And welcome back to our webinar series, Sally. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jim. And thank you, Ebony, and to the Australia Institute for this opportunity to speak today. I want to add my acknowledgement of the traditional owners on the lands we meet. I'm here in the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. And given last week was NAIDOC Week, I also want to acknowledge the ongoing struggle for First Nations people for treaty truth and a voice. I hope the union movement can continue to play its role as a trusted ally with First Nations workers at the heart of the broader workers' struggles. I also want to express my solidarity to everyone in Sydney, Greater Sydney. I know people in Illawarra, the Blue Mountains, Central Coast don't think of themselves as Greater Sydney, so shout out to you as well. There's a deep conundrum at the heart of the government's story about their economic management, and that's what I want to talk about. As my colleague, ACTU President Michelle O'Neill, said in a speech before the budget at the National Press Club, the Liberal Party in this country have had a political stranglehold on the definition of good economic management. Trickle-down economics, the weaponisation of government debt, demonisation of the safety net. And this is how they've controlled the economic levers of government. Well, this might be the year where their cover is blown. The COVID pandemic still raging around parts of the world, and in my hometown of Sydney, it's highlighted perhaps more than any other previous moment in history, the fundamental distinction between the well-being of all of society and the wealth and affluence of the rich. Around the world, millions have died, tens of millions face frightening disease, and economies were humbled. Yet stock markets hit record highs, including here in Australia. The wealth of Australia's billionaires doubled during the pandemic. Profits rose 10% despite the recession and mass unemployment. It's very clear that what the government views as a strong economy is namely more profits, higher stock markets, and more wealth for the rich. And it's not necessarily good for ordinary people. We'll never see stronger proof that wealth does not trickle down. In Australia, for the last generation, wealth has actually trickled up, and during the pandemic, the trickle has become a torrent. And here's the conundrum for them. They were boasting about the strength of the economy post-COVID prior to the Sydney lockdown. The government has trumpeted out the economy as a tribute to their management, with consumer demand roaring back, employment recovering, the stock market rebounding, profit going up. But whenever they're asked to stand up for working people and wage earners, their story turns dark. Their strong economy becomes a house of cards that can be blown down by the smallest puff of wind. Increase the minimum wage? Well, the time's just not right. It'll hurt business. Improve workers' rights? Well, that could really bring us all unstuck. Do we need to do something about insecure work? Well, that would be just impossible. A break on productivity and business needs flexibility. Use the government to invest in proper services and Australian jobs? No, let's just leave that to the private sector. It appears the economy can be both strong and weak at the same time. And whether the economy is strong or the economy is weak, the government believes workers should get less. At least there's one point where the government is consistent. However, this year, for the first time I can remember, while the federal government were beating their chests about the recovery, wages came into the spotlight. Now, Australia, as many of you know, was once admired around the world, and rightly so, for our high levels of inclusive prosperity and equality. You know, the Fair Go, Sunshine Harvester decision of 1907, supported by decades of struggles by the Australian union movement, is how we fought for and we tried to protect a system for people that was meant to be governed by rational and moral principles rather than economic brute force. We pioneered the idea of a living wage. We led the way on the eight-hour day. We built systems of awards that were unique in the world. They ensured a level playing field and fair compensation for workers across different occupations and industries. That system is still globally unique, despite it being watered down to a safety net rather than a way to lead progress for all workers. The post-war era, Australia had a prosperous and productive economy, which was good for workers. Social and economic equality, while certainly not perfect, rivaled the advanced social democracies of the Nordic countries. It was a uniquely Australian social contract, uniquely Australian bargain, the Fair Go. Well, this all began to unravel with the advent and ascent of the neoliberal economic trickle-down economic policies. Now, these policies came to Australia in a unique way, reflecting the particular historical and political circumstances of our country, but they came all the same. And Australia today has lost our reputation as a land of the fair go. As others have noted, when the Governor of the Reserve Bank says there's a problem with wages, the issue is clearly at crisis point. For over the past decades, wages did allow gradual improvements in the real state of living for most workers, their real standards of living. Of course, there were too many people who still fell through the cracks of our industrial relations system, but there was an established pattern over the years of wages keeping up. And the data tells us something changed around the end of 2013. Well, I wonder what that could have been. I seem to recall a certain election and a certain prime minister coming into office at that time. Of course, it wasn't just that election. There are other factors that mattered as well. And the whole course of wages was shifted onto a different track and has been stuck there ever since. Since late 2013, according to the ABS Wages Price Index, nominal wages across the whole economy have grown at an average of 2%. Wage growth in the private sector has been even weaker. The Wage Price Index doesn't tell the whole story because it eliminates the impact of changes in job composition over compensation. A lower wage part-time and casual jobs are expanding as they have been, then the growth of the overall wages is even weaker. 2% is barely half the pace of the traditional wage growth in Australia. And contrary to the comforting rose-coloured forecasts of government and business economists, this wasn't a short-term blip. It's now a well-established trend. Every year in the official budget forecasts, this government has said, don't worry, wages are going to strengthen, supply and demand conditions are tightening, the market will fix it. Every single year, the government's been wrong. Year after year, the government predicted a rebound in wages growth. Every year, that rebound failed to materialise. Most of all, they can't say how they will get wages higher. 8 straight years of very low wage growth. And this has been the worst wage record in Australia's post-war history, 8 straight years. And the pandemic really has made things worse. I don't need to tell you all that the pandemic has made it worse. It's important to note that workers entered the crisis in a very weak position. The economy was slowing. In 2019-2020, bushfires caused huge damage and uncertainty, and we were already enduring 7 years of record low wage growth. The pandemic and resulting recession have made things worse. Nominal wage growth effectively stopped altogether in the worst months of 2020. On a year-on-year basis, it fell below 1.4%, the worst since the Depression. There was a tiny improvement in the March quarter of this year to 1.5%, but nothing to restore confidence. And there's no sign things will get better without deliberate, concerted action to make it so. There's no reason for employers to change their behaviour. Employers naturally take advantage of their power. And when the problem has been so obvious for 7 years before the pandemic, we can't just blame COVID for the crisis in wages. We can't let the government and employers use COVID as a scapegoat when their own failures were obvious for so many years.
Sally, let me interject here just for a moment. You've highlighted this really long-lasting downshift in wage growth to 2% a year for 8 years straight. Let's bring consumer prices into it. The reason I ask is some people say, well, inflation has also been very low, so it's not such a problem that wages are low. That doesn't make sense to me, but tell me what you think and tell me about what's happened to real wages, real purchasing power in this time.
Well, 2% increase in nominal wages for 8 years running is bad enough. But remember, consumer prices are rising over that period too. The change in real wages after accounting for CPI was actually close to zero. And that's, workers can't buy any more goods and services with their wages. Moreover, the total CPI measure of inflation doesn't tell the whole story. the cost of necessities that workers have to buy, so food, energy, housing, have gone up faster than the cost of imported luxury products and non-essentials. You know, so according to the ABS, while prices have increased for discretionary spending by 18.1% over the last 15 years, prices have increased for non-discretionary spending by more than twice as much. So that's 43.8%. Therefore, the performance of workers' real purchasing power has been even worse than the official numbers indicate. And as you note, Jim, some commentators have argued that since nominal wages grew slightly faster than CPI during the pandemic, so workers should stop complaining. But inflation has been rebounding since May last year. And if inflation continues to increase, then real wages will take a further hit. And you look at the government's own budget forecasts, they expect wages to grow below CPI for 2021 and 21-22, and merely just match CPI for the year after. So in other words, even the government expects the real standards of living of Australian workers to fall. You know, the question is, what is the government going to do about that? Wages are the most important price in the economy. They're not just a price, they're also the basis of spending. When wages are growing slowly, spending can't grow either, and it's also another sign of the failed austerity policies. We've had wages basically utterly stuck in the mud, and we've had inflation that's fallen below the RBA's own official target for 7 years in a row. It's a sign of profound economic weakness. And if you think about other countries, our current wages crisis can't be judged just on our own history. In comparison to the rest of the world, Australia has one of the worst wages trends of any industrial country. According to OECD data, average nominal wage growth in the 5 years before the pandemic was ninth worst amongst 35 industrial countries. In real wage terms, we were the third worst. And measuring relative to inflation, remember, real wages basically went nowhere for those 5 years before the pandemic. So it can't be argued that the wages crisis is a universal global phenomena. Yes, workers around the world face huge challenges trying to protect their standards of living and win real wages. But here in Australia, we were once a land of the fair go, workers have fared especially badly. That means we have to look at our own policy failures, the failures of our own institutions. We can't blame market forces. The record weakness of wages for the last 8 years in a row has exacerbated another problem, which was also around long before the pandemic. There's been a huge redistribution in Australia's economic pie away from workers and in favour of corporations. And that trend started long ago, but reached unprecedented levels of extreme during the pandemic. And this is a direct and predictable result of deliberate policies put in place to suppress wages. Workers are producing more output every year thanks to their new skills, new technology, and rising productivity. In fact, Australian workers produce more value add with each hour of their labour than any time in history, but their compensation is not remotely kept up with their productivity. This can be seen in the major reduction in workers' share of total output, their slice of the national economic pie. Labour compensation, including superannuation contributions, hit a record low of 47% of Australia's GDP in 2019. That's the lowest annual average since the ABS started reporting this data back in 1959. And from a peak labour share of 57.4% in 1975, over one-tenth of the economic pie has been taken away from workers. That loss of 10.4% of GDP is worth $208 billion in today's terms. And that works out to a stunning average of $20,000 in lost income for each and every waged worker in Australia. During this same period, the share of GDP going to corporate profits has grown steadily. Went from under 16% of GDP in 1975 to over 26% of GDP, highest ever, in 2019. That's an increase of 10.2 percentage points and it's worth $200 billion. So workers have lost a 10% share in the GDP pie, and corporations have gained a 10% share in the GDP pie. Decades of deliberate efforts to suppress wages, disempower workers, enrich and empower businesses have paid off. The distribution of national income has shifted dramatically and is dangerously in favour of business. And this was the whole point of neoliberal trickle-down economics. It's worked for business, it just hasn't worked for anyone else.
Sally, I've just got to jump in here again. My jaw has dropped at that figure, $20,000 of foregone wages for each and every waged worker in Australia because of that shift in distribution over that whole period, that last, 40 and some year period of neoliberalism. I think that's the kind of thing that should get people rioting in the streets, to tell you the truth. Well, maybe not rioting, but at least marching and protesting and striking. I think people are angry about this. They may not know that number yet, but I do think people are angry that the promise of improved standard of living has not occurred, has not been met. How do we transform that anger into sort of a constructive movement, an effective movement that gets wages growing again?
Well, first of all, we've got to be clear about the problem. What is the problem we're facing? Because the other side, the people who are benefiting are kicking up a lot of dust and saying it's a whole lot of things it's not. So every month there's a new theory trying to explain low wages. One week they say it's because unemployment is too high, and when unemployment comes down, then wages will go up. Then they say it's because productivity isn't growing fast enough. Then the next week it's, there's a problem with underemployment. It's too high. We've got to wait for that to be fixed somehow. And last week they started saying it's because immigration has been too high. So talk about ignoring the very big policy elephant in the room. And it's time our country faces up to the truth so we can see what that problem actually is. The wage crisis for workers, the destruction of the Fair Go, the creation of a working underclass, betrayal of the great Australian bargain, is a deliberate outcome of conscious policy. It was caused by policies designed to weaken the bargaining power of workers. When workers try and bargain in Australia, it's like being tied to a chair and asked to stand up when every arm, every leg is tied down. Over the years, as employers have won precedence to the detriment of working people, the laws have become even more restrictive and the bonds have tightened. And the easier it has been for employers to outsource and casualise jobs, the more those bonds have tightened. Our bargaining rules operate to severely limit and restrict working people at every step. Now, last year, when the government oversaw talks between unions and employer groups, we again witnessed employers trying to loosen the restrictions on them and push back on the very few protections workers still have. Workers have less and less access to collective bargaining because of all these one-sided, over-regulated regulation has crushed the power that workers have to convince their employers to lift wages. In the past, Australian workers could rely on bargaining and the award system, which allowed strongly unionised workers to drive wages growth. This helped those workers, but it also dragged up those without bargaining power as well. It set a floor, it lifted all workers up. But the current laws do not support workers bargaining for wage rises. Collective bargaining is harder than it's ever been for working people, and the award system operates as a mere safety net, basically frozen in place and unable to respond when there are changes to wage levels in an industry. The inability for awards to move upwards, even when there's clear cases of gendered undervaluation in work like childcare and aged care, it's actually creating incentives for employers to outsource work, to casualise work. So as unionised workers won better pay increases over time, they're played off against workers who only got the award wage. Employers who only pay the award undercut those employers with bargains. This is how labour hire companies have prospered. They've marketed their services as a method of cutting wages, as good, secure, properly paid jobs are replaced with insecure, low-paid jobs. And employers have been given more rights and more parachutes to help them out paying decent wages and conditions. As a result of the Horizon decision of the full bench of the Fair Work Commission in 2015, employers are now able to argue that enterprise agreements should be cancelled altogether if it's been too hard to bargain. And this means workers' wages and entitlements can be radically slashed, stripping them of 20 years' worth of bargain gains overnight. You can just imagine that. This is a threat employers have been using at bargaining tables ever since 2015. Come to an agreement or suffer a unilateral pay cut and lose important job security safeguards built up over the years, like redundancy payments. Or the effect of all of these threats have further tightened those bonds I talked about. So it's just no wonder we have a wages crisis. Wages won't rise if workers don't have bargaining power. Wages won't rise if workers don't have rights. Our wages problem is a bargaining power problem. Employers have too much and employees not enough. With all the power in the hands of employers, wages no longer move in a way that fairly shares the gains of productivity, of profits, of our nation's wealth. That is why there's been a 10% shift from working people to corporations. We have low wages growth because we have policies that deliberately suppress it. This is a problem that won't be fixed until those policies change. Australia's dedicated and creative trade unionists struggle every single day under this system. But unfair laws make our jobs harder than it is for our union colleagues in the rest of the OECD, harder than it even is for union members and activists in the United States. Governments impose wage caps, just like employers impose low wage policies. Workers struggle to break them because, unlike employers, they're tied to the chair. Our bargaining system needs to be updated, it needs to be rebalanced to give all workers the ability to access the system to deliver fair pay increases. This includes options to bargain across sectors and industries, as is now occurring in New Zealand. Our award system needs to be adjusted so it operates as a proper industry floor that can be adjusted as wages in industries change. Urgent action is also needed to make jobs more secure by making unlawful the fiction of permanent casual. Make unlawful labour hire, rorting the system to replace permanent, fairly paid jobs. Make unlawful the so-called gig economy jobs that have no rights. Make unlawful, unending fixed-term contracts. Now, you would think the Morrison government might have an empathy moment in 2020 as hundreds of thousands of casual workers lost their jobs overnight and had no sick leave in the middle of the pandemic, just like the casual workers in Sydney at the moment. But actually, it seems their empathy levels are stuck on couldn't care less, because instead, a few months ago, they passed laws to entrench casual work and entrench labour hire. They gave the labour hire corporations exactly what they wanted, and that says it all. Insecure jobs have been coming back with vengeance after COVID lockdowns. 60% of new wage jobs created since last May are casual jobs. 57% of new jobs since May are part-time. In the self-employment sphere, 80% of new self-employed positions since May are precarious, with proprietors having no incorporated status, no paid employees, or both. Instead of seizing the moment, ensuring workers have better job security, they did exactly the opposite. And now, as I said, the casual workers in Sydney are the ones feeling the pain the most. In 2 weeks' time, Jim, as you mentioned before, our movement, the Australian Union Movement, comes together for our biennial conference, where delegates from every union debate our policy and our direction. And it's clear we'll be meeting in the shadow of our country's latest COVID lockdown, with our largest city facing its greatest challenges since the pandemic began. And I guess this makes our work even more urgent, and it gives us greater focus. Workers have been on the forefront of the battle against COVID, and we intend to be at the heart of debates about how to recover and rebuild. We will not accept a recovery that entrenches unfairness and disadvantage. We will keep fighting for the hardest hit in the latest lockdown. We will continue to raise our voices in support of a competent vaccine rollout. We'll hold this government to account on the issue of workers' wages. We'll keep fighting for better laws. That's our commitment. Thanks, everyone, for your time, and thanks for this opportunity, both Ebony and Jim.
Thank you so much, Sally. That was amazing to hear from you on all those issues. Certainly a lot to consider there, and just a huge response from everyone online today. So there's about 760 people online with us. Thanks so much for joining us. We are going to come to questions from the audience now. We've got about 40 questions already, so we'll try and get through as many as we can. Sally, we were talking there. You obviously touched on a whole range of issues. The first question that I've got is from Matthew Corless. He says, how do you feel about the RBA, Phil Lowe from the RBA, saying that immigration has helped keep wages low for years?
Well, to be fair, what he actually said was the use of temporary visa workers was part of this problem, not immigration. I know that it might have sounded like that when I said it, which wasn't correct. And I think that it would be absolutely naive and wrong to think that it hasn't had an impact. It has. And we in particular know that because studies have shown one in three temporary visa workers are victims of wage theft. And if you think of it this way, insecure work, so casual work, is also a vector of a whole lot of things. So if you're in insecure work, you're more likely to experience wage theft, sexual harassment, and poor safety standards. Now, if you're a visa worker, it's like you're supercharged insecure work because your job is dependent on having the visa. So it's even a more precarious position than those people in insecure work. So where obviously we have whole sectors where there's so much wage theft, inevitably that drags down wages. And secondly, there's the other issue of too many employers in this country have just found that easy, lazy ways of you know, dealing with skill shortages and also dealing with productivity. And that's about cutting wages, cutting jobs. And instead of training up and investing in training their workers, they've just thought, we'll let another country do that and we'll bring people in on a visa instead. And that has meant the long-term consequences for us as a country where we've underinvested in TAFE, where we've not invested in the types of education that our system needs or our population needs to deal with technological change. Instead, we've just thought, well, okay, that's fine. We can just use the visa system as a substitute. And that has been the wrong way forward. And so inevitably, the issue of the over-reliance on temporary visas where employers have not had to see whether or not a local could do the job first. They've just been able to do it is also part of the story, but it's like a part. The bigger issue is the underlying structural problem about bargaining rights because, you know, people on visas are subject to the same repressive, you know, laws that the rest of us are in terms of trying to bargain for wages increases.
Yeah, I did want to come back to that, Sally, because it's, you know, I think something that we hear a lot about, the wages crisis, but it's never directly linked to, well, this is a deliberate outcome. Our chief economist, Richard Dennis, sometimes talks about, you know, the government has been doing this for years. This is the outcome that they're after. And now they're kind of the dog that caught the car. The RBA is worried about it, as we've touched on. The government has the power to change this, but do you have the sense that they actually do think that this is a problem, or are they just willing to ride it out? Like, is there, what's your sense on how much they are actually willing to change some of those policy settings?
I think this government's completely caught. They know it's a problem. They know that it affects the overall economy. They know that they can't achieve, you know, their own targets that they've got in their own budgets without wages growth. But they cannot go to the issue of adjusting workers' bargaining power. And that's because of the strong vested interests that would kick and scream about that. And I got to see that up close last year in the discussions with employer groups about our industrial relations system. What they were focused on was how can we make bargaining easier for employers? And the changes they wanted were all about removing the few protections that are there to make sure that, you know, bargains don't reduce in wages being cut. simply that's what they were after. Every proposal we put forward to deal with making sure that everyone can access the bargaining system, so looking at updating and modernising our system so that, you know, workers, for example, in early childhood can collectively bargain across the sector around making those laws fairer in terms of how workers can go about having bargaining power, were rejected, like out of hand. And that's because there's no way that this government has any intention, the willingness or otherwise to balance things up for working people. And I think that there's actually a whole lot of, you know, people in business that don't care that it's a problem for the overall for the budget, because they're doing very well as we just went through it. Like they are, you know, getting the benefits of that policy. So I think really what the government does is point to every other problem or every other you know, reason or explanation for this problem in order to avoid what is actually the truth.
Jim, if you can just unmute there, I might come to you on this one as well. The next question is from Chip Ealing. He says, does the ACTU have a strategy to win back the right to strike, and can we achieve adequate wage growth and other protections without this right? Sally, I'll come to you first on that, but then Jim, I thought if I can come to you after that on other international comparisons as well. So Sally, first to you, the right to strike.
Well, that's obviously been, you know, a key part of repressing workers' bargaining power. And for those who don't know, for those of you who have never collectively bargained, and I'm sure a lot of you have, but all of you who have know that you can only take industrial action in a very sort of narrow or lawful industrial action within a very, very narrow time frame and according to complicated laws and, you know, rubber stamping votes. Notices, it's sort of like you've got to wait for that one part where it's sort of, you know, the sky has got Venus in this part of the sky and that the moon's rising at exactly this point, and then you're able to do it. So, you know, the fact that employers know that, it's not about sometimes taking, you know, industrial actions. The fact that employers know that you could, and that changes the equation when you're bargaining. And when the employer sort of knows from the beginning that, you know, if you were to do this, they're going to see you coming months and months and months ahead of time, and they're going to have every opportunity to slow it down and make it difficult, that clearly is part of suppressing workers' bargaining power. So like any reform of the bargaining system just has to make these things fairer. It's about rebalancing it. You know, in the overall way of us being able to win this is, first of all, to be able to point to the fact that wage growth, the wage crisis that's now not just affecting working people but will, of course, affect businesses as well, as consumer power is spending is suppressed, needs to be addressed. I'll hand over to you, Jim.
Yeah.
Well, the point of the international comparisons is very interesting in many ways. And on the right to strike, it's galling. You know, in the years that I lived in Australia, it was a real educational experience for me to learn about all of the hoops that you have to jump through and all the hurdles you have to overcome and all the incredibly micromanaging details in the Fair Work Act and all the other legislation and regulations governing unions, just to do things that unions in other countries just do as a matter of course. It's considered part of the normal, legitimate, healthy functions of unions, including to use the leverage of a threatened work stoppage to try to even out the scales in collective bargaining and win decent wages. And that's a striking insight, because we often hear about the argument of conservative economic policies or neoliberal economic policies being all about getting government out of the way. That's often a slogan that's put out there. You know, we're to step back, get government out of the way, let the market rule. But where it comes to industrial relations, they're not getting government out of the way. Like, take a look at the Fair Work Act. Take a look at the 1,000-plus pages of the Fair Work Act that describe
exactly. I think it's behind Sally there.
Yeah, maybe it is. What they can and cannot do. And that is the nanny state writ large. All of those restrictions. The problem is that the power of the state in those areas is being used to entrench the interests of business and stop workers from doing anything. And that goes to other areas of normal industrial relations as well, like even things like what you're allowed to negotiate. I was incredibly amazed to learn that in Australia, they have this whole category of regulations about what are the legitimate topics that can be put on the bargaining table. And in my experience in other countries, you put anything you want on the bargaining table if your members support you doing so. And it's all about policing and vilifying and undermining the normal function of unions, which is to offset the otherwise concentrated power of employers. And I don't think people in Australia realize how unusual those regulations are. It isn't the normal way of doing things. Australia really is an outlier in the international community in terms of how restrictive and repressive our industrial relations system has.
The ILO also commented on that too, to the Australian government. They wrote to them about that and about their obligations. And that internal contradiction, you're right, Jim. I just think business and the Liberal government will hate red tape, except for us, where they just can't get enough of it. Like more and more red tape they're happy with.
Yeah. The next question is from Evan Walton, and I think it touches on, again, the levers that are available to government. He says, how effective is the lever of APS wages, that's public sector wages, in driving overall wage growth in the economy? And why has the government disabled that lever through wages policy, given it's one of the few that they have?
Yeah, well, the second part of that question is a question for the government. They've done it, obviously, to keep their wages bill down. They are the biggest employer in the country. And so on one hand, they'll say that they want wages to go up. On the other hand, for their own employees, they're doing everything they are to keep it down. And tomorrow they could change that policy. Tomorrow they could go into the CPSU and offer a pay increase that then sets the standards. So obviously the public sector competes with the private sector for workers. And that if they raise wages, it sends a big signal to everyone else around this. But at the moment, they've got no intention of showing that leadership. In fact, the fact that they keep that cap or that, the wages down and they're doing everything they are to keep wages down is contributing to the problem.
Jim, did you want to add anything to that? I know the Centre for Future Work's done a bunch of stuff on public sector wages caps.
We have, including showing all of the different ways that the wage caps in public sector and wage freezes in public sector work trickle down into the rest of the economy. I mean, Sally is right. The governments, including the state governments, are the biggest employers in the country. So there's a direct impact on overall wage growth. They make up about 15% of all employment. So if they're going to keep wages at 2% or 1% or even 0%, then that obviously pulls down the average. Then there's what we call a demonstration effect, where employers in the private sector look at what governments do because, it gets headlines and it's a kind of a benchmark. And then they go to their own workers and say, look, the government's only offering 2% or 1% or 0%. We can't do any better than that. In many cases, because these businesses are suppliers to government. So they'll say we have to keep in line with our customer. Then there is what we call the macroeconomic effect, because it means that public sector workers have less wages and less money to spend, and there's that much less consumer spending going around. Therefore, less demand for businesses in the private sector, who then feel all the more compelled to tighten their own wages. So it's an absolutely self-defeating mechanism. I think Sally's right. They're trying to keep their own wage bill down. I also think there's a kind of ideological or symbolic thing to it. The governments feel, this is how, I'm going to show that we're being tough on costs and tough on our own workers, and they think they'll get some kind of populist political benefit from that. But economically speaking, it's like shooting yourself in the foot.
Mm. The next question is from Ian Paulin, who says, if we've learned anything from COVID, it's that the most important participant in the economy is the worker/consumer/citizen. And he says, as a policy researcher, I'm convinced the growth economy model is dead for the next 5 to 10 years, and a sustainable economic model needs to be the responsible frame. How do we get a motive other than profit in the picture? Sally, first to you.
Oh, I need to, the bit about, the labels of those two I'll leave to economists, but the government's sort of own economic modelling around the budget assumes that consumer spending is going to increase, I think it was by 5%, more than what it was at its peak post sort of the end of last year. So there's all this pent-up demand with the lockdowns and with people that might have spent their money elsewhere, and then this sort of, you know, big sort of sugar hit in the economy from just, you know, consumers, normal people spending. And now they're sort of assuming that it's going to increase another 5% on top of that at its peak. How does that fit with record low wage growth? It doesn't. Like, it's not, the two things don't go together. So, again, like, that's another big threat to economic recovery. And it's a point that really needs to be made to business too. Like, they shoot themselves in the foot by all the time saying that wages got to be kept low. Who do they think buys their stuff? It's us. It's working people. And if we don't have money in our pockets, less stuff we're going to buy.
I think we spoke to you kind of not that far into the pandemic last year, and you talked a lot about how our concept of who an essential worker is had really radically shifted during the pandemic. Do you think that's a permanent change, that now, you know, the person at the supermarket who stacks the shelves, they're absolutely essential to our economy in a way that none of us had probably realized before?
Yeah, I think that's right, even though Gladys seems to be struggling with this issue. But putting aside that, being able to sort of see who is actually needed to keep things going, like to keep us at a basic level. And it's the people in Fairfield at the moment who've been told that they've also got a test every 3 days. And on one hand, you know, that government says that, oh, we're going to leave it to individuals and we know people will do the right thing. We're not going to impose rules. And all of a sudden, for the essential workers of Fairfield, well, we've got a new rule and the police will pull you over unless you've had a COVID test. It's like, who do they think, like, is going to be providing their food? Who do they think is working in those factories to produce all of that? Who do they think is delivering things to keep everyone else who, you know, in the eastern suburbs, going? It's the people in Fairfield, and they're telling them they've got to line up for 6 hours in order to get these tests. So they're sort of also paying for, you know, that policy. So I do think it changed last year, but I think it's also a lesson about how quickly things can go back to taking people for granted.
Yeah, thank you. The next question is from James Tucker. He says, and can I just say, I'm not sure if I'm not seeing them in here, but I'm really struggling to find some questions from women in here. So can people get upvoting them? There's like 40-odd questions. It's really hard for me to find them. I'm feeling like I'm missing a bunch there. But the next question is from James. He says, wholeheartedly agree with your message. My question to you is, how do we get the majority of Australians to understand and vote accordingly? Many years ago, I started hearing from younger people that they don't necessarily support the union movement, and nowadays many of them are trapped working in insecure employment, and yet many of them do not support Labor or aren't a member of a union. How do we change this? Sally, how do you join your union?
Well, actually, research last year, the independent research that's been done and public research that's been released and our own sort of research actually shows that unions have never been more popular. Like, we've sort of like hit these highs of that. But the thing is that, and Jim will probably can add to this in terms of international comparisons, we also have this unique system where union members pay for, like, all of the good work, all of the pushing up of wages, all the improvement of conditions, all of the ability for us to stand up for those people, you know, missing out, like those insecure workers, and for that change, whilst, you know, union membership has shrunk. And so there's no, if corporations had to do what we did, which is basically produce a product and then give it away for free and then say, well, you can pay for it voluntarily. Now, of course, unions are more than that. It's a collective, you know, strength of people acting together, but explaining that to people is not people's everyday experience. So that takes a bit. But, you know, this system of open shop and that sort of allows, just leaves a few people to pay for everything else is a problem, like it is. In terms of, so on one hand, like we've never been more popular, but that doesn't mean that people are then just going to join. So obviously there's a lot that unions are doing around this, in particular on the issue of insecure work. I think that, you know, a lot of people got used to the fact that they may never have a secure job, and not because they chose to and not because they wanted to, but because they had no opportunity. And you always want to be optimistic about the situation you find yourself in, like you can cobble several jobs together, you know, all of that. And all of a sudden last year, the first lockdown happened and people just lost their jobs brutally overnight, and then were left out of JobKeeper because government didn't realise that, you know, there's a whole lot of people that, you know, in that first 12 months of being a casual, like that were going to, you know, be left out. And then, you know, in these so-called essential jobs, like in aged care, people don't even have sick leave because they're in insecure jobs. So I think it's been a big wake-up call for the country that we've got a problem with insecure jobs. The Australia Talks survey that the ABC did, so that's a massive survey of attitudes the Australians have got. 88% of people said that insecure work is a problem for our country. So I feel as though the dial is turning on this, but it's going to take more than public opinion, or it's going to take more than people saying, yes, unions are doing a good job. It's going to need people to actually join us.
Mm. Thank you. The next question is from Claire Elliott. Thank you, Claire. She says, given the obvious detriments of neoliberal economic policies, do you think there is a role for the universal basic income in addressing baseline poverty?
I think that there's an issue in terms of being in a situation where the consequences of that type of system, where you don't address all the other structural issues. So you say, okay, we bring in a basic income, and okay, well, it's totally fine now for everyone to be in insecure work and gig economy, et cetera, because of that, you know, basic, you know, income that's there. And that, in a way, I sort of feel like it's sort of saying to you know, the rich that are doing really well, okay, let's come to a new bargain. You pay us like a small amount to everyone, and we'll just accept the massive inequality that we've got. And so I just think that there's got to be much, much bigger changes, and there actually has to be changes that have to do with empowering the many rather than the way that we've gone about it at the moment.
Thanks, Sally. And thanks to everyone for helping upvote questions from a bit more diverse range of people. The next question is from Lois Wishart. She says, why does the federal government continue to pursue low wages growth and casualised work that necessitates workers taking multiple jobs as security guards or aged care staff? So really getting to that, the heart of that question about the more insecure work, having to take multiple jobs to make ends meet. And she's tacked on the end there, why is the government seeking to destroy the superannuation system when the result will be more people reliant on the government pension? Do you want to take insecure work first and then super? And then I might come to you, Jim, for a couple of other observations.
Government loves it, and they love it because the employer class, not all of them, but a lot of them love it. They love the fact that, you know, insecure workers, they're more at their beck and call. Like, it's harder to say, I'm not going to do something that's unsafe if you know you can just be left off the roster tomorrow for no reason. And the reason why employers do it is because they can, is because the laws allow them to, and the governments are enabling that. So I don't think that the government's sort of unhappy with this situation. And, you know, they might see the consequences of it at the moment, you know, in aged care, obviously, with the multiple jobs and all of that. But it's not as if they're sort of moving to say, oh, well, we need to address it and have all of these changes. And it's for the same reason I said before, like, you know, their backers would never accept them making those changes. You know, perhaps, I guess, like, to be fair, if you were even the Liberal Party, if you were brave enough, like, to say, actually, this is bad for the whole of the country, you'd go out and you'd go and argue that with your constituency, what you saw as your major constituency, and you'd argue for those changes. But I don't see that happening at all, actually, even in the near future. In terms of superannuation, like, it's a really good point, like what a drag it will be on, you know, assuming that they would pay for people's support if you didn't have super. They don't like, you know, things that are universal and that are good for everyone. So that's why they don't like Medicare either, because, you know, it provides like a system that supports everyone and it sort of goes against their sort of, you know, basic ideology. And the other thing is that, you know, they've got in their heads somehow that that means that, you know, these unions are controlling all of this money, which of course isn't true. Super funds are run by both employers and unions. And they do very well. It's like this one point in Australia where actually employers and unions work together for a common cause to make sure that people have good retirement, the best retirement they can. And that's delivered. And it's delivered also because the system is not for profit. Like, you know, no one's trying to make money out of it. They've just got one idea, and that's return to members. And so it should be held up as an example of like the way that our country should be going in terms of, you know, looking for common ground and working together, and held up for that reason. But instead, you just got these relentless cultural warriors in the Liberal Party that are hell-bent on destroying it. And I guess they do so too because all that money they probably think should be in the hands of their mates in the banks.
That's a good summary. Jim, did you have anything you wanted to add on that, on insecure work or super?
Yeah, let me just come back on the insecure work and its connection to the pandemic. I mean, first of all, the fact that so many of the initial job losses when the lockdowns occurred were concentrated among people in insecure work, vastly disproportionate, 8 to 10 times as many people in casual jobs or part-time jobs or labor hire positions lost work during the initial lockdowns. And those are the people who could least afford to lose work. That's the incredible irony. There's a lot of, you know, relatively well-paid professionals who could do their job on a computer, could take their job home, who didn't lose a cent from the pandemic. And then the ones who could least afford it are the ones who lost it. Now, you know, someone like Matthias Cormann would say, that's a design feature of insecure work. That's the whole idea. You know, you get rid of them when you don't need them. No muss, no fuss for the employer. And we saw that design feature in action, and it destroys lives and it destroys families and it destroys communities. Now we have the recovery happening, at least until these new lockdowns in New South Wales, and insecure work is coming back with a vengeance. As Sally mentioned, the vast majority of new jobs are casual, insecure, part-time, precarious, and the government's changes in IR cemented the ability of employers to hire for casual positions in any job that they deem casual. It's a travesty. Casual job is now any job an employer says is a casual job. So, you know, what does that mean? And we've done some work. I've sent the link in the chat by our economist, Dan Nahum, about how casual and insecure work actually contributed to the spread of COVID because of people working in multiple sites and, of course, people not having access to paid sick leave. So, this is really an important problem, and it is tied to the low wage growth that Sally has documented.
Just very quickly, Sally, one last one. I've got a young union organizer. He's 21, Cameron Strauss. He has started working as the union rep for the TWU for Swissport in Sydney after they took over the Qantas jobs, and is about to hold his first offsite Zoom union meeting to help unionise his colleagues. Any tips for him on how not to stuff up our progress, he asks.
Good luck, Cameron, first of all. You know, it's a tough time for those workers, and it's sort of such an important job that you're doing. The tip I give for you is that always remember the union is the workers, and that you know, what happens on that Zoom meeting, as much as possible, should be led by them, and your job's to resource that and to help build unity on a way forward.
Thanks very much. Is there anything else you want to leave people with before we wrap up there, Sally?
Just solidarity to everyone in Sydney, the Blue Mountains, Central Coast and Wollongong, and I do believe Shell Harbour.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm so sorry that we can't get to all of those questions. There were some real crackers in there, but I do hope we got to a good range. Thanks so much for tuning in today, everyone. Thank you to our guest, Sally McManus, and to you, Jim, as well. Our favourite Canadian, Jim Stanford.
This has been a special webinar episode of Follow the Money. All our webinars are free and available on the Australia Institute's YouTube channel, which you can find at australiainstitute.tv. All our latest research and content is at our website, australiainstitute.org.au, and we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is ebony_Bennett with a double N double T, and our producer is Jennifer Macy. You can find her at Jennifer Macy, and our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum, with additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. Thank you for listening to Follow the Money, and I hope you're having a great summer.